Now it's time for Ari Zivotofsky, Dr. Rabbi Ari Zivotofsky, professor at Bar-Ilan University, halachic voyager, travels the world, the inventor of the Masorah dinners, really writing in the OU magazine, always the myths or facts and fictions, so to speak, on Judaism. It's a pleasure to welcome back for the beginning of a three-part series, Dr. Ari, Vakasha, it's all yours.
Okay, maybe it'll be four-part, five-part. We'll see how much we get done here. Okay. Because I want to talk about a few different challenges or seemingly conflict between some of our ancient halachas and things that have come up either because of modernity, because of the modern state of Israel, questions that relate to animals. And so as an introduction, obviously, we're going to have to first talk about Tsar Balei Chaim, either one, two, three. We'll see how many lectures on Tsar Balei Chaim. Tsar Balei Chaim is a topic that's thrown around, or a phrase that's thrown around a lot. Whenever you don't like something that's happened with animals, Tsar Balei Chaim. So what I would like to do is learn Tsar Balei Chaim from the sources, see what Chazal have to say about it, see what the poskim say about it, see what the sources are, and discuss some specific cases where the Isser either comes up or doesn't come up. And it's important to keep in mind that really this is the oldest animal welfare code in the world. For most of the world, including Western society, concern for animal welfare just didn't exist. Meaning even going back 200 years, there was no such things as ASPCA or Anonymous, as we call it here in Israel, or PETA. The organizations that were concerned for animal welfare just didn't exist. And the fact that the Rabbonim got shailas about Tsar Balei Chaim and paskened about it and wrote about it was really way ahead of their time. Now, Tsar Balei Chaim, as I mentioned, it comes up in lots of areas. And the question is, what's the source for the prohibition? When does it apply and when not? So we're going to see regarding animal welfare laws within halacha, there are two types. There are very specific, narrow laws mandated by the Torah, meaning the Torah gives a specific halacha for a specific case and doesn't wait for the Jewish people to say, there might be a concern of animal welfare, let's invoke Tsar Balei Chaim. But rather, there are specific narrow laws. And then we're going to see in a minute, then there is very general. Some examples of specific narrow laws. The Torah tells us, Ki terecha mor sonecha rovit tachet maso, v'chaldaltem azov lo azov tazov yimo. You see somebody's donkey overloaded and the donkey is having trouble. You have an obligation to help out. Shabbos. Shabbos, we know, is for two reasons. It reminds us, as we say in Kiddush, of Briat Olam, and it reminds us of Yetzias Mitzrayim. Well, those are the Aseret Dibros. In addition, the Torah tells us, why do we have Shabbos? Sheshit yom taseh masecho, uv'yom ashvi tishpot, leman yenuach shocho v'chamorcho, v'yinafesh ben amatcha v'ager. Meaning, an additional purpose of Shabbos is so that your slave, as well as your shor and your chamor, can have a day of rest. This one in Dvarim, very similar to the one we saw in Shmot, that there's a specific obligation to help if you see a donkey or an ox that's falling on the side of the road. It's prohibited to plow with two animals together, two different species together. Various reasons are given in the Mefarshim. The Torah obviously doesn't give the reason for the prohibition, but some of the commentators explain, well, if you have a shor, which is very strong, and a chamor, which is weaker, and you're trying to plow with them together, it will be unfair to the chamor. Others say, no, it's unfair to the chamor for a different reason. He sees the shor is always looks like it's eating because it's a ruminant. The chamor is not a ruminant. And the chamor thinks, hey, why is he eating and I'm not getting to eat? So whatever reason, lo tachosh b'shor v'chamor yachdav, a specific prohibition, which the commentaries see in it a reason that has to do with animal suffering. Lo tachsom shor b'disho. When the animal is doing daish, when it's threshing, you're not allowed to muzzle him. Meaning the shor is helping you in your farm work. While he's helping, you can't muzzle and prevent him from eating. Those are all biblical prohibitions. And then there's a very, very famous rabbinic one, which we're going to spend some time talking about. The Amar Rab Yehuda, Amar Rav, Osel Adam Shiochal, Kodim Shitin Machal Lebemto. You're not allowed to sit down and eat a meal until you have fed your animal. Shenemar, V'natati esev besadcha levemtecha v'hadar, and afterward v'chalta v'savata. So the pasuk tells you that things are going to be good. God's going to bless you. And when he blesses you, you will have food for the animal in the field, and you will eat and be satisfied. And we see that in the verse, first comes the food for the animals. From that, the rabbis learned out that there's an obligation to feed your animal before you sit down and eat. So very, very specific rules, halachot, that relate to Tzar Balei Chaim. Now, why? The last one, if it's a rabbinic, and we'll see in a minute, some people say maybe it's biblical, but most say it's derabbanan. Why should there be such a prohibition? Why should you have to first feed your animal and then eat? Well, Rav Kook gives four reasons why man should not take precedence when it comes to eating. Now, Rav Kook is known as somebody who's very sensitive to other people as well as sensitive to animals. Just to dispel the misconception, Rav Kook was not a vegetarian. Rav Kook did write about a potential future of vegetarianism, but Rav Kook was not a vegetarian. But nonetheless, he was very sensitive to animal welfare, and he gives four explanations why you should feed the animal before you eat. One is, he said, human responsibility. He said it has nothing to do with what today we call animal rights. There's no animal rights. And we'll see in halacha in general, it's that we have obligations. We have obligations towards others. We have obligations towards animals. So human responsibility towards others includes towards animals. And if you have a responsibility towards another, you have to take care of that first before you take care of yourself. Hakara tov to animals that provide our food. For most of history, the animals helped us in the field. The animals helped transport, and the animals provide the food directly in terms of milk, in terms of meat. So you have to have hakara tov. The animal provides you with food. You have to take care of him before you eat. Then he gets a little more mystical. He says the human soul is sustained by not only bread. We also have a spiritual side. Animals have no spiritual backup, and therefore you have to take care of the physical side before you take care of your physical side. And then he says in purely physical terms, animals are superior to man. Animals are stronger. Animals are a physical being, and therefore their food comes before your food. Rav Kook doesn't mention this, but others explain this halacha as that you can't explain to an animal that just wait, I'll be back in half an hour and I'll feed you. He can't understand. Well, the human can understand. The human can know that he could be patient. An animal doesn't understand that the hunger is temporary, and so its suffering is greater. All of these are reasons why one has to first feed the animal. Now, very interesting how once you have this halacha in the Gemara, and it's a very simple, short halacha, we find it in the Gemara in two places. The halacha, you have to feed the animal first, the pasuk which you learn it from. From that, you have now a huge edifice that has been built in the halachic literature. Does it apply to all animals? Does it apply to food and drink? Does it apply if you have other humans other than you around? And what I'd like to see is some of these other sources. So the Rambam mentions, the first of you, halacha v'nei magen avram, hevi b'simen reisha ein aleph, b'shem tshuvas maharam, d'le'echol kodem abeim, who is the Araisa, who mashmid the Svirle du Drosha Gemura. So the Ber Halacha brings that there are those indeed who say that this is an actual mitzvah d'oraita. The Drosha from the Pasuk is an actual Drosha of Halos Machta. V'lefizeh Poshet, d'afilu Berach HaMotzi, Tzorach LaHafsik. If it's a biblical obligation, if you made HaMotzi, and then you realized that you haven't fed your animal, well, you got to interrupt. You can't eat yet. You have to go out and feed your animal, and then come back and eat the bread. He says other authorities don't see it that way. Other authorities understand that it's a derabbanan, and therefore, if you've washed, then you could eat the bread, take a bite of the bread, and then go feed the animal. What's interesting, the Rambam seems to do a little expanding here. He says, when they ate and they had an eved in the house, they used to make sure the eved, the slave, got to eat some of every food that they ate. And they would feed the eved and the animal, like we saw in the Gemara, before they themselves ate. Now, from the language of the Rambam, it implies that this is not even a derabbanan to feed the eved before, to give the eved from every tafshil, just meritorious. But you see, the Rambam seems to have expanded here what we learned in the Gemara, and none of the reasons that we saw over here from Rav Kook would apply to the Avodah. Well, not none. Okay, how about drinking? The Gemara only mentioned eating. So the Magen Avraham says that ma'achil lebehema, you feed your animal, havei tzorchei sidu da'as lit'om kodem shite lebehemto, avol lishtot, when it comes to drinking, adam kodem, the man comes first, and he brings a proof. How do we know it? Well, an example from one of the forefathers, or the matriarchs. Kedashkachan berifka, sh'ama shtei, v'gam gamalecha shtei. So Rivka said to Eliezer, I will give you to drink, and then I will give the camels to drink, implying that you're allowed, or maybe you have to give the person to drink before the animal. Okay, and Lenny's the Taz of Lenny's diet, the anus of Bitima Balma, he says, you also let it eat a little bit. It's only Achila Suda. You can't have a full meal, but you're allowed to have a taste. And if you go back to the, well, we saw in the Be'er Halacha, in that case, if you washed, you certainly could take a taste. Okay, now it says here in the Shut Har Tzvi, Rav Tzvi Pesach Frank, the chief rabbi of Yerushalayim in the 50s and 60s, he says, Baha, the os lecha kodim shokh lebehemto, ha-shelik fodo b'divra magan avram, b'shem sefer chasidim, shekos b'ha d'omri os lecha kodim shokh lebehemto, yesh chilek ben achil ashtila. He too says there's a difference between eating and drinking, and he too learns it out from Rivka, that Rivka gave the Eliezer to drink before the animals. However, he now goes further. He says, "V'shol ma tam? Why should I distinguish between eating and drinking? If we have whatever the reason is that you're not allowed to eat before you give the animal, that should apply to drinking as well." And he gives two reasons. He says, "I have two reasons why drinking maybe is less of a problem. One, the yesh lomah de tzar shel tzoma kasha yoter v'lechem b'tzoma enu mechuyv lahatil behema." He says, "When a human is thirsty, his suffering is more than his suffering when he's hungry. And therefore, that degree of human need, and we're going to see this is going to come up a lot, that you evaluate the human need versus the animal suffering. And what Rav Tzvi Pesach Frank is saying is that the human need in the case of thirst is greater than the human need in the case of hunger. And therefore, you could eat before you give the, you could drink before you give the animal to drink." And then he gives another reason. He said, "Onomati dat tam hu mishum de ba'achila." The same thing, and he elaborates by davening, for example, or by other mitzvahs. You can't sit down and have a meal before you do a mitzvah because you might get carried away with the meal and it'll go on for hours, and you might forget the other mitzvah. You might forget ma'arif. Here, you might forget that your animal is waiting to be fed. But a drink is very quick. You take a drink, and then you're not going to forget, and you're going to go out and you'll feed your animal. And then I thought, fascinating, Rav Moshe Feinstein said, you know what? He said, yes, if it's you versus your animal, the animal comes first. But how about little kids? If you have little kids who can't eat on their own and you have to feed them, vaday hem kodmin lahabehemot. You have to feed your little kids before you feed the animal. And if we look back at Rav Kook's reasons, it depends on the reason, but some of them would explain Rav Moshe's chiddush over here. For example, the animal can't understand that hunger is temporary. Well, that's true as well with the kid. The kid won't understand that you're going to feed him in 10 minutes. And therefore, it could be an human responsibility. You're responsible to feed the kid. You're responsible to feed the animal. Which one comes first? The kid comes first. So Rav Moshe says that again, you versus the animal, you have to feed the animal first. Kid versus animal, you have to feed your kid first. And then what I thought was a fascinating tshuva of the Yavit, of Yaakov Emden. He was asked, do you have to also feed your cat and dog before you eat? Now this goes back, Rav Yaakov Emden was 1700s, early 1800s. I always thought, Jay, do you have a exact date? And I think he's early 1800s.
Yaakov Emden died in 1776, I believe. I believe, okay. Which you should know as an American.
Okay, so Rav Yaakov Emden, 1700s. I always wondered, did Jews have pets back then? Did anybody have pets? Well, it seems Jews had cats and dogs. And he was asked, do you have to feed your cat and your dog before you eat? And what's the question? Well, clearly, when the Gemara was talking about feeding your pets, And when they're talking about that the pets, or the animals, not your pets, that the animals help you with food, they were talking about farm animals. They're talking about cows, about sheep, about donkeys. They weren't talking about pets. And you hear of Yaakov Emden has people with pets. Animals, didn't have all of those theories about spiritual and physical. They understood it as a simple quid pro quo. The animal works for you. You have to feed him before you eat. And so the questioner is saying, maybe it's only the animals that work. And the cat and the dog, they're your pet. And Rav Yaakov Emden says, first of all, even if that's going to be your rationale, nah. Mistabra de chashiv enam ibnei malach ktsat. Cats and dogs, they do a little work for you. What work do they do? They are very, very busy catching mice in your house. It could be 1700s, Northern Europe, a lot of mice running around, and the cats were kept very busy. So indeed, he says, your cat is working for you, you have to pay him. V'chein kelev, your pet dog, avorato gedola, he does big work for you. He's there, very busy, protecting your house, keeping an eye from wild animals and from robbers. So if, he says, you're wondering, do I have to feed the cat and the dog first because they don't work? They work for you. So anyhow, I think just from this truth, a lot of interesting things. First of all, as Professor Chaim Soloveitchik likes to say, you could learn a lot of history by looking at the tshuva literature. Here you could see that Jews in the 1700s, I don't know what percentage, but Jews in the 1700s had pet cats and pet dogs. And I think his logic is very interesting, how you see that he wants to maybe say it's a trade-off. He works, you feed him. And he says, here you see that in his mind, the cat and the dog were not just companions, but they were working for their pay. So he ends up, the end of the tshuva is... Shema mina behedi the club where is it? Begam nizom b'tzirachpo v'kelav ein tzochnim zot habe. He says you don't have to because they feed themselves. He says that's his reason for finding. It's not that they don't work; they do work. He says, but the cat, how does it work by catching achbarim? That's his food, and the dog, he manages to find food on his own. So you don't have to worry. Okay. Then, very interesting, Teferes Yaakov writes like this. He says, you might think, well, every time I sit down for a meal, I have to go feed my animal, whether it's my cow or whether it's my pet dog. So I want to eat, I have to go feed him. He says, no, it's again only when there's a conflict. If it's his time to eat and my time to eat, I have to give him first. But if it's not his feeding time, I don't have to go out and feed him. I can sit down and eat. It's not that once you become an animal owner, you're now tied to the fact that you can never eat without feeding your animal. What the Teferes Yaakov says is no. When it's time for the animal to eat, you have to feed him. But otherwise, you could sit down and eat. And then, just like Moshe Feinstein saw when there's a conflict between kid and animal, kid wins, he says, V'nira im yesh lo orech al shuchano, so again, he says, if we have conflict here, conflict of hachnosas orchim against feeding the animal, in this case, the hachnosas orchim wins, because when you have a conflict of two values, you have to evaluate. And in this case, Teferes Yaakov says, hachnosas orchim is a bigger value. Now, I don't know what hachnosas orchim meant then. And as our rabbi, our shul, likes to point out, inviting your neighbor for a Shabbos lunch isn't necessarily Hachnosas Orchim. That's just a social get-together. Hachnosas Orchim was you invited in the poor person who was going from shtetl to shtetl. So when he talks about Yeshlo Orech, I don't know if he meant a hungry pauper who showed up and now he gets to eat before the animal, or he means any guest. There could be any guest. I no idea. Okay. I gave a long list at the beginning of some of these very specific mitzvahs. Some of them were things that you could understand there's a Yetzer Hara, and the Torah needs to therefore command that you have to overcome your Yetzer Hara. You see your enemy with his donkey, and his donkey is weighted down. you might think, I'll let him take care of it, or the donkey anyhow is really strong, and I want to walk by. But some things you wonder, is there really a Yetzahara? Why does the Torah have to say, Lo tachosh b'shor v'chamor yachdav? Why would you think of doing such a thing? Well, it turns out people actually think of doing such things. Here is a picture from the Library of Congress. These were taken by the American colony. They were here in the late 1800s, early 1900s. This is in the American Library of Congress, a picture from 1890. And you could see, indeed, a local, I guess, Arab here plowing with a shor v'chamor together. And that wasn't the only example. Here you have, again, from the Library of Congress, 1900, here in the land of Israel, plowing with a cow and a camel together. And it gets better. Here we have, again, these were religious people. So they even put a note, plowing with a cow and an ass, and you see that's what they were doing. This is all Library of Congress, pictures from the land of Israel, late 18, early 1900. And I guess if you have only one animal, you're left without a choice. Here you see, again, they're plowing a few animals together. And then talk over here about in April 1929, picture was taken by head of the Scots mission in Tiberias. Again, you see a cow and a donkey. And then there are people who really have no choice. This says a native plowing with his wife and donkey from Palestine. So now the question is, what does halacha say about this? Halacha says in general, any two species are prohibited. But does that include a human? The Mishnah in Kalayim says, Va'adam mutar im kulam limshoch v'lechosh lanig. So of all the pictures, this one would not have violated the isser of lo tachosh b'shor v'chamor yachdav. But you see, obviously, this is something that the Torah had to outlaw if it felt it was tzar b'alei chayim, because there is a Yetzahara for it. They have a native plowing with his wife and donkey in Palestine. I don't know the year. How about lo tachshom shor b'dishol? There, I guess there's a small Yetzahara, but how much is the ox going to eat while it's treading on the grain? Well, again, early 20th century Library of Congress, you see that they actually would muzzle the oxen. You might think, okay, that was a long time ago. Here is in Ethiopia in spring 2013. I visited, this is in the northern region of Ethiopia, in Tigray. And here they're actually threshing just like the way our forefathers did it 1,500 and 2,000 years ago. And when you get a close-up look, you could see that they've tied their mouth closed over here. Do you see my mouse? Did you see? And you could see the mouth of all of them is closed. So indeed, it seems that people, lo tachsom shor b'disho, there's the Yetzahara and people do it. Okay. This is more about lo tachsom shor b'disho. We'll skip some of those. I just want to mention here, what's very interesting is that, again, when you have conflicts of values, that's when you see how to evaluate the strength of each one of them. And when does the Isser apply? Now, we haven't yet gotten to the general prohibition of Tsar Balei Chaim. These are all specific prohibitions, and therefore, it's a specific Isser without a reason in the Torah. So when it comes in conflict with another mitzvah or another Isser, Chazal just had to weigh the two, one against the other. So you have the Pasuk, Lo Tachsom Shor B'Dishol, and then the Mishnah tells us, V'chein Para Lo Tochal B'Karshinei HaKodesh. The cow is not allowed to eat from karshinim. It's a type of legume that belongs to the Beis HaMikdash. That's Hegdash. What's it talking about? Well, the Rambam explains, Im Dash Karshinei Hegdash. If you have an animal that's Dash, that's doing, I forgot again what it's called, that's going over these karshinim, Hare Zechayev Lachsom Et Para Bishad Disha. So here we have two different values. One is you're not allowed to muzzle the animal, presumably because it's a problem of causing suffering to the animal. It's a problem of tzar balei chaim. On the other hand, produce that belongs to Hegdish, you're not allowed to feed to your animal. And which one wins? Well, the Mishnah ruled that you have to muzzle them. Rambam explains, Omer Yisala, Lo Tachsom Shor B'Disho. The Pasuk says you can't Muslim when he's doing daesh, but it's your daesh, b'disho, rotzel omar, but daesh u roi lo, that's fit for the person to eat, kloma le, or for the animal, kloma le shor u shlo tachsom, of a b'daesh hegdish, shu asur lo chasom. meaning that there is a conflict of two values. You might say, with a modern concern for animal welfare, okay, he'll eat only a little bit. I realize that he's not allowed to eat from the Hekdesh. I'm not allowed to muzzle him in general. And in this case also, I shouldn't muzzle him because the animal will suffer. And what the Mishnah is telling us is that no, it could be in this case, it's a small degree of suffering that the animal has. And therefore, Chazal said, based on a drasha from the Pasuk, that when he's doing Daesh for the produce of the Beis HaMikdash, not only may, but you must muzzle him so that he doesn't eat from that produce. So we see, and we're going to see it again and again, that Tzar Bale Chaim is not an absolute, and it's not across the board for everything. We'll see that it's, as I mentioned, the earliest animal welfare legislation, and we have to always take into account if it applies or not, if the animal is suffering. But when there are competing values, in particular, we're going to see whether it's a human value, feeding your kid, feeding the guest, drinking and you're suffering, then the human takes precedent. And in this case, we see that the Hekdesh, the holy produce, takes precedent. However, sometimes it's a stronger prohibition. A Mishnah in Chulin is talking about the prohibition of slaughtering a animal and its baby on the same day. There's a prohibition of Otoviet Benoah. You're not allowed to slaughter the two of them in the same day. Maybe that also is because of Tzar Bale Chaim. Again, there's no reason given in the Torah. Maybe it's to teach a little bit of sensitivity to the person, because even if the animals are in two different places, the mother and the baby are in two different places, there's no tsar to the animal. They don't know that the other one is slaughtered, but there is an insensitivity to the person doing it. If the person knows that the mother and the baby were slaughtered on one day, that's too much of a achzoriot for the Torah to let us do it. In any event, there's a prohibition of otoviet benoah. And it has with it, because it's a very specific prohibition, again, it has very specific guidelines. And the Mishnah says, "Hashochet v'nit nabla." If you slaughter, but it didn't come out kosher, it came out in a vela. Or hanocher, you just kill it in some other way, other than a kosher shchita, patur mishum otoviet benoah. You have not violated the prohibition of otoviet benoah. That prohibition only applies if you slaughter it kosher. What Rabbi Akiva says, that the Mishnah could have said just patur. The whole parak, the whole chapter there's talking about otoviet benoah. There's no reason for it to say patur mishum otoviet benoah. You did not violate that prohibition. So he says, diakein, he said you did violate that prohibition, the mishum otoviet benoah, the patur. He says, you still did something wrong. Killing the mother and the baby on the same day are a prohibition of Tzar Bale Chaim. You're right. The specific, the narrow prohibition of Oster Vespino, you didn't violate, but you did something wrong. And that's why the Mishnah has to say, you didn't do Oster Vespino. Because that's what these Mishnahs are talking about. It's telling you about that specific prohibition. And again, here, very interesting, behema makshleleid, a cow, a sheep, an animal that's having trouble getting its fetus out. So the Mishnah says, chotech mu'ubar shemeha mutar, and now it tells you, if you cut it, you cut from a piece in mutar b'chila, if you cut a piece of the animal inside and then you shecht it, you can eat that piece. But minat chol, minat klayot, if you cut from the spleen or the kidneys, you can't eat it. But what's interesting was that Tiferet Yisrael says, if you cut a piece of the fetus in order to help get it out, and it says, v'lo hutzia ei v'shachatach, v'shachar eim, etc. He says, the Mishnah says, loshen chotech, you can cut up the fetus. Why? The afilu l'chadchile mutar. You're allowed to do that even ab initio. The kashiyesh lo shum tzorach medover, ein kan mishum tzar balechayim. V'hachari osakein la'akel yitzirto la'atzil eim. He says, I have your case of a mother animal that's trying to give birth. The mother is suffering and the farmer is having trouble. The farmer wants to save the mother. The farmer wants to make it easier on the mother cow. So he has only a few options in front of him. One of them is to cut up the fetus. And what the Mishnah is saying is that you might think that there's a prohibition of Tzar Bale Chaim. So it's saying, no, again, we have this these two values, to save the mother, which is a human need, as well as to relieve the pain of the mother, which is another animal's need. and the problem of cutting up the fetus, you're allowed to cut up the fetus. Okay, and I will skip some of these other examples. Okay, one more very, very specific example that would seem to relate to Tzar Balei Chaim is the mitzvah of Shechita. We might say, now Shechita, how does that deal with Tzar Balei Chaim? You're killing the animal. But what the commentaries point out is that part of the reason for the rules of Shechita is to minimize the suffering. Yes, the Torah says you may eat meat, you may slaughter an animal in order to eat the meat, but you have to do it in a way that the Torah tells us minimizes the suffering. It says, V'od, this is Sefer Chinuch, who always gives reasons for mitzvahs. V'od ne'emar b'tam shechita min ha'tzavar u'b'sakin baduk. Why do you slaughter from the neck? Why do you slaughter with a knife that's sharp and smooth? Kedei shelo nitzar b'alechaim yoter midai. So the animal shouldn't suffer any additional suffering. Ki ha'Torah ha'tiran la'adam l'malato lizon me'am l'chol tzarchav. The Torah has permitted human use of animals, but lo litzarom chinam. The Torah has not permitted man to cause pain to animals for no reason. The kvar dibru chacham harbeis litzar b'lechaim ba mitzia shabbos imhus deraisa vel lefiadom and shosim b'deraisa. Okay, and then a fascinating ketam sofer. Ketam sofer follows up on this sefer chinuch, and he says v'zeh tam shchita u'mashom litzar b'lechaim deraisa v'zu. Birchotenu. What's the bracha? Tzar Balei Chaim is a prohibition from the Torah. Says, what bracha do we make on it? He says the bracha on Tzar Balei Chaim is Asher Kedushanu B'tzav Tzivanu Al Hashchita. When a shochet makes the bracha on Shchita, he is demonstrating that we're doing this mitzvah because there's also a prohibition of Tzar Balei Chaim. So he says there indeed is a bracha on Shchita, a bracha on Tzar Balei Chaim. What's the bracha? It's the bracha on Shchita. V'nir Midvarov. This is from the Ramban. The Torah permitted meat, but it wanted to make sure that you don't become cruel to animals or cruel as a person. When a shochet makes that bracha al shechita, it's as if he's saying, Asher k'dashar b'tzav tzvano, l'rachem al b'riyot, to have mercy on the animals, on the creatures. So a fascinating thing that the Chestam Sofer sees here, the Rabban really, but the Chestam Sofer follows up and expands on it, that Shechita is really an active expression of the prohibition of Tzar Balei Chaim. And now, sort of to conclude the section on the specific, because we saw there are a lot of specific mitzvahs that all seem to relate to Tzar Balei Chaim. When you have a specific mitzvah in the Torah, it comes with its specific guidelines. And like, for example, lo tachsom shor b'disho, you're allowed to do it, or you must do it if it conflicts with Hegdish. So too, the Prima Gadol says, tam mitzvah zu, you want the blood to come out fast, first of all, because there's a prohibition of eating blood, and you want the animal to die faster. And then he says, this is the Prima Gadol. The Prima Gadol is a commentary on the Shulchan Aruch. And in his introduction to Shechita, he says, Kfar katru kulam, she'en liten tam al shum mitzvah, v'chein chamesh v'chot Shechita, af she'b'ksat shum nimtzim tam an aleim. He says the reasons for each of the specific rules regarding Shechita, there may be reasons, and we may try to explain why each of these different rules, but those reasons don't affect the rules. Meaning this today, as I'm sure you're all familiar with, there's a big debate in Europe about permitting Shechita, banning Shechita. Some countries like Switzerland have banned Shechita already for over 100 years. Other countries have been toying with it recently. And there's a lot of scientific research that goes on around Shechita. Some groups in New Zealand claim that Shechita is painful. Other groups, you know, Professor Levinger did his PhD on this, where he wanted to show that it's minimal pain. And the question always is, if you can come up with a method that's less painful, if you could show I can modify the knife somewhere and make it less painful, would we do such a thing? And the answer is, that no, we're concerned with Tzar Balei Chaim, but also the specific narrow rules are not modifiable. If you could show me that there's a better way to transport the animals that minimize their suffering, 100% we would go along with it. We want to minimize the suffering in the entire process. But in the narrow rules that govern shechita, or that govern lo taksom shor b'disho, or that govern plowing with animals together, those rules are not modifiable, even if you could find that there's a way to make it less painful. Okay, just before we get to the general rule, I think it's interesting, there are a few drushas that they try to show again, that the rabbis throughout the ages were sensitive to animal suffering. The Pasuk tells us that V'yakov nasa sukos of yivin lo bayis l'vineos sukot. Yaakov Avinu coming back to the land of Israel, he comes to a place called Sukkot, and he built himself a house, and then for his animals, he built Sukkot. And then the Pasuk tells us, Al kein kara shema makom Sukkot. Why was the place named Sukkot? Because Yaakov built Sukkot for his animals. And the Or HaChaim says, what kind of explanation is that? The Pasuk is saying, Yaakov comes back to the land of Israel. Yaakov built a house, and then Yaakov built Sukkot for his animals. And because he built Sukkot for the animals, we should call it for that. He says, Vim tom of chibishvil shos Hashem Yaakov sukkah, yikrela makom kain. And then he says, Ulai ki asad davar chadash. He says, this was something novel, that a shepherd should be concerned for the welfare of his sheep. He said, because he did this novel construction of building shelter for his animals, and essentially the Torah wants to emphasize this. The Torah wants to say, yes, this is good. This is something you want to emulate. Yaakov innovated. He showed that you have to have extra sensitivity for your animals. And because of that, the Torah says, we're going to emphasize that to remind us forever after. When you call the name of the place Sukkot, you will remember it's called that because Yaakov had compassion on his cattle, on his animals. And some of the commentaries even saw a concern for the social welfare of the animals. The Torah mandates different kind of korbanot for different situations. And it says in Blos Yirei Tahara, when a woman after childbirth and gestation bring korban leben or lebat, to be kevus ben shtatol la'olah ben yonah or tor lechatat, she has to bring a sheep for a na'olah and a pigeon or a turtle dove for a chatat. And then if she can't afford the sheep, she brings just two pigeons and two turtle doves. But the Baal HaTorim says, fascinating. He says, He says, B'kol makom, every time when the Torah tells us about those two birds, pigeon and turtle dove, makdim torim l'b'nei yonah. It always puts the turtle dove before the pigeon. Chutz mikan. Here in this pasuk, when it's telling you what to bring, it puts the pigeon first. Why? L'fish eino mevi ele echad. He's only bringing one bird. V'im yimtzei yonah lo yikach tor. If he could bring a pigeon, he should not bring a turtle dove. Because according to the Baal HaTorim's understanding, a turtle dove mates for life. And if you're going to now take a single turtle dove and sacrifice it, his mate is going to be lonely, is going to be alone for the rest of her life, his life. He says, therefore, if you have a choice, take a dove, because a dove doesn't mate for life, and therefore it's even if he was already mated, he'll find somebody else. So what the Baal HaTorim is saying here, now, I don't know if this is true. I'm not really sure that they actually mate for life. But the Baal HaTorim is saying that the Torah wanted to express a concern for the social structure of the turtle dove, because the Torah doesn't want you to take one mate of a pair because of concern that then the other one will be lonely for the rest of its life. So again, is it true in terms of the animal behavior? I'm not sure. But what you see is the Baal HaTorim, living 700 years ago, is expressing this sensitivity about an animal's social welfare. So all we've talked about till now were specific narrow laws. But we're also familiar with there's a general provision and a principle. There's the prohibition of Tsar Baalei Chaim. It's a general principle that most commentators assume was of biblical origin. We'll get to that in a minute. It includes most pain, psychological, and to most animals. It's debated whether it includes non-shechita killing, meaning if we've said just now that shechita is the most painless method of killing an animal, may I kill an animal some other way? However, this general prohibition is permitted for most human needs. Meaning that if you need to use an animal as a pack animal, the animal probably is not happy with that, but you're yet allowed to use him for a pack animal. If I'm going to lead him straight up and down plowing, he might want to go one side or the other. I'm allowed to plow with him. In other words, Tsar Bala Chai is permitted for most human needs. There is a component of intent, meaning the reason I'm causing this particular pain or suffering to the animal is relevant if I'm allowed to do it or not. And this general law does not override the specific laws. So we just had a long list of specific laws. Now we're going to have this general law of Tsar Bala Chai. And what's important to keep in mind is, again, what we said near the bottom here, is that it's permitted for most human need. The question is, why? If God wants us to have compassion on animals, if there's a human obligation towards the animal not to cause suffering, why, just because I have a need, can I now cause the animal to suffer? The Gemara says, it's talking about the flood in the time of Noah. It says, V'yimach, it's called Yukum HaShal Pnei Adamah. And the Gemara then asks, Adam Chata, Behema Mai Chata. Why did God drown out all the animals? Granted, humanity was a disaster. They just weren't doing what God wanted, and therefore God wiped out humanity. But why should God have killed all the animals? What did they do? Tanam Shumi Abishua Ben Kocha, Mashallah Adam Sha'asa Chupa Libno, Vahitkim Mikomene Sudal, Liamim Meit Beno, Omadu Pizer Chupato. A person has a son who's engaged, and he prepares a huge wedding feast for him, and then the kid dies. So what does he do? Obviously, takes it apart. He takes away the chuppah. He says, Klumasiti ela bishvil b'nei, akshav shemeitu, chuppah lamali. He says, if the sun isn't there, what do I need all that food for? Alpha Kodesh Baruch Oma, klum barati behem v'chayi ela bishvil adam. The whole purpose of creating the animals was to serve man. Akshav shadam choteh behem v'chayi lamali. What do I need them for? And Ramban adds a slightly different twist to it. He says, ki Hashem bara kolam b'nivrim mitachtonam l'torach adam, ki hu l'vado, meaning humanity is the only living being that recognizes God. And therefore humanity is the pinnacle. The other parts of creation, including animals, are there to serve man. And therefore, if there's some human need, and again, we're going to see, it's not any human need, and it's not any type of suffering, but human need can trump Tsar Bala Chai. And the Ramah brings here, just to summarize, the Ramah brings in Shulchan Aruch Eben Ezer, kol devar tzarich lerfuah o l'shar dvarim. If I need the animal for some sort of medicinal purpose or for anything else, let be mishum isur tzar bale chayim. Okay, and we'll get that in a few minutes, but just it's worth always remembering this in Shulchan Aruch Eben Ezer Simen Hay, because I was always blown away when it must be almost 40 years ago when Rabbi Kellermer, who those of you who know Rabbi Kellermer know that he knows kol haTorah kulo, he came to us Hempstead. And my brother, the veterinarian, came to Rabbi Kellermer and had a question about Sirus, about neutering animals. And on the spot, Rabbi Kellermer referred him to the Pische Tshuva in Eben Ezer Simen Hay. And we were like just blown away. So that's, now I like to quote that and show, wow, pretend as if I know some Eben Ezer. Of course, he knew the Simen before and after. I don't. Okay, so skip to these. Okay, we mentioned that it's for human need, even for other animal need. You could sometimes cause an animal to suffer. The Mishnah says, "Ein mialdenes behemus biyontif avol masadim." You can't help birth. You can't be a midwife for an animal on yontif, but you can help out. And what does that mean? The Gemara says, "Omar Rav Shimon ben Gamliel merachmin," meaning Rashi says, "Ma'avin et vlada aleha." You make the mother have compassion on the baby. He says, "Rachin Hainu al behema Torah biyontif." Hechi Ovid, how do you do that? Amar Abaye, maybe bul shel melech. You bring a lump of salt, umeniach la betoch harechem, and you put it back into her womb. Kedei she tiskut sara v'terachem alav. And Rashi explains, what do? You bring a fistful of salt, and you put it in her womb, and it causes her some pain, and that reminds the mother of the birthing pain, and she remembers, oh, I just had a baby. I'm going to take care of the baby. So according to this Gemara, you're allowed to cause pain to the mother in order for the mother to take care of the baby. So here we have not a human need, but a need for that baby. If the mother animal doesn't take care of the newborn will die. So therefore, because of that need of another animal, the Gemara says you can cause pain to the mother. Okay, where do we get the prohibition of Tzar Balei Chaim? We saw that there are all of these very specific halachas. So one might think, okay, there are a lot of specific halachas. The Torah could just write, V'lo tegrom tzar lebehema. It doesn't. There's no specific prohibition in the Torah of Tzar Balei Chaim. So what happened is, the commentaries, the Gemara, looked and they searched and they tried to find a source for this. So first of all, the Gemara in Bab Metzia and the Ran and Shabbos and Rashi and Ritva all say, you know where it comes from? It comes from the mitzvah of unloading the donkey of your enemy. Just like you have to unload the donkey to relieve him of pain, we learn that anything else that causes pain, you have to avoid. The Meiri says, no. It's from a different one of those specifics. Lo taksom shor b'disho. Just like you can't muzzle him because that causes suffering, it's a generalization. Anything that causes suffering, you can't do. The Rambam in Moreh Nevuchim and a Medrash HaGadol say it's from this coming week's Parsha. Oh, I guess for us, this coming week's Parsha. You guys in the Chutz Laretz are a week behind. Always behind their Chutz Laretz. The Malach says, the angel says to Bilam, the Yom Ralav Malach Hashem, al ma hikita et atorcha. Why are you hitting your donkey? And the Rambam learns from that the fact that he criticized Bilam for hitting the donkey must mean there was something wrong in what he did. And the Rambam says that's the source of the biblical prohibition of Tzar Balei Chaim. The Chetam Sofer, obviously not happy with any of these previous ones. Remember, Chetam Sofer is very early 19th century. He says, no, it's from a totally different source. He says, there's a mitzvah of imitet yodeo, to imitate God. Mahu rafu mafu, mahu mal bisharum, mafata mal bisharum. And he says that we know about God that verachamav akol ma'asav. God has mercy on all creations. Just like God has mercy on all creations, we have an obligation to emulate God. Chita Mekubetzit says, none of these really speak to me. He says, why? How do we know that there's a Isser of Tzar Balei Chaim? He says, it's halach l'moshe misinai. There's nothing you can argue about. You don't need a source. It's a halach l'moshe misinai. So we see that there are lots of potential isurim. So I had this list, and then I came across a fascinating thing. When you find a list like this, it means that there's a concept, but that we don't exactly know what the source is. As Rav Meidan said, I just heard this recently, I think it's beautiful. He says, when you hear lots of reasons, you know none of them are the ultimate reason. Rav Meidan said, I know of 9 reasons why we read Megillat Rut on Shavuos. I can only give you 1 reason why we read Megillat Esther on Purim. Meaning, he says, I know why we read Megillat Esther on Purim. There's only 1 reason. It's obvious. He says, why do we read Megillat Rut? He says, I don't know. There are lots of drushes, lots of reasons, but none of them are the ultimate. What's the ultimate reason here for Tzar Balei Chaim? So I found that Rav Osher Weiss says it beautifully. He says like this, in a pashut hadavah, bil mivad tayag mitzvah shabbatorah, shuma al adam lakayim mitzvot rabot. He says, yes, we have tayag mitzvot. 613 listed, very narrow, very specific. He says, but in addition to those 613, it's not enough. He says, we have many mitzvahs. Sha'af hei minat Torah that are also biblical in nature. El shalo nimnen b'minyan atayag. They're not included in the tayag. Mishum shalo nemru b'loshin tzivoy b'forsh. Doesn't say velo tigrom tsar lebehema. It doesn't say that a command. Umikol makom ratzon Hashem shi'atam shi'asotam. It's the divine will that we should do them. Hadam v'chaybem ratzon ze lemedim anu mitoch toras Hashem. He says there are many other. He says mitzvahs or concepts that are the divine will, and we learn them out of the Torah. V'shnei drachim. How do you learn it from the Torah? There are 2 ways that we learn ma ratzon Hashem. It says, yesh lemeidim anu mitoch mitzvahs haTorah, inyanim v'kamarasam. We can learn it from the mitzvahs. We look at what the mitzvahs are, and they tell us what the divine wish is, the divine desire. Like over here, you look at unloading a donkey, muzzling the ox, and you learn the divine desire of not causing pain. So that's one way. Me'az u'mikodem regili ha'isi la'vi es ha'makor ha'bolet v'ter l'get. The zesh ratzon, shem yirash ha'amu b'ar tzar balei chaim. So he brings Tzar Balei Chaim as the example. I'm sorry, I skipped it. He says the second source is the stories in the Torah. And that over here, we have a story, for example, about Bilaam. The story about Bilaam, clearly hitting the donkey was a wrong thing. The story we had with, you have other stories about Viracham of Akomasov, about treating animals properly. So we have, he says, two ways of learning the divine will, from other mitzvot and from stories in the Torah. And he says the classic example in his mind of divine will is Tzar Bale Chaim. He says, "En Tzar Bale Chaim lo lav, lo ase." There's no specific prohibition, there's no specific command. And le'issu bavad, it's a biblical isser. Matzinu b'zeh, he said, Yud Aleph Jochem b'divra b'steinu. I found 11 different ways in the Rishonim and Achronim to learn out the prohibition of Tzar Bale Chaim. So he says that it's divine will. If I may, Jay, I think most of the people here are in Chutz Laaretz. I think another example that Rav Asher Weiss meant to bring is the divine will of living in the land of Israel. Even if it's not a specific one of the Taryag mitzvahs, the Ramban thinks it is, the Rambam doesn't list it, but it's clear from so many mitzvahs, from so many stories, that Ratzon Hashem, in the words of Rav Asher Weiss, it's Ratzon Hashem that the Jewish people live in the land of Israel. So here Rav Asher Weiss says it's Ratzon Hashem that there is a prohibition of Tzar Bale Chaim. And he found 11 different drushas. He brings Rashi, that's Prika, like I mentioned, the Shita Mukubet, etc. Anyhow, I'm not going to bring them all. But he brings the Sefer Yom Tshuva, he says, we learn it from V'dibartam, when Moshe was told to talk to the rock, V'dibartam elasela, V'otzetalem mayim, V'shkita esa eda, you have to feed the people and their animals. So you see, they have to take care of them. Anyhow, he brings 11 different sources. What's interesting is the Rambam, as I said, learned it out from the angel criticizing Bilaam in this week's Parsha. Bilaam is not Jewish. Meaning, if the Torah is telling us that there's a prohibition of Tzar Bale Chaim and is teaching us through Bilaam, that raises an interesting question, which Torah Ledas brought up, Torah Ledas, written by Rav Matas Blum. He was the first of these weekly Parsha sheets that today have exploded. He unfortunately passed away due to Corona. Few weeks ago, he raised, there is a discussion found the various firm concerning whether a ben noach is forbidden to cause pain to animals. We often talk about the sheva mitzvahs b'nei noach. The sheva mitzvahs b'nei noach aren't seven specific narrow, because as in the sense of the taryag. Because, for example, among the sheva mitzvahs b'nei noach is avodah zarah. That's one of the sheva mitzvahs. In the taryag, you could find 20 prohibitions related to avodah zarah. Among the sheva mitzvahs b'nei noach is gilui arayot. You could find among the taryag probably 50 specific narrow ones that relate to gilui arayot. So too, it could be that Tzar Bale Chaim would fit in with one of those seven, under one of the seven categories. Particularly according to the opinion in the Gemara in Sanhedrin, that one of the seven was neutering animals. And in that case, Tzar Bale Chaim could easily fall under that. He just brings this question of whether there's a prohibition of Tzar Bale Chaim for a non-Jew. Okay. Although the Gemara debates whether this general prohibition is derived to Abonin, according to almost everybody, the Rif, the Rosh, the Brachinich, the Tur, the Ramah, the Bach, the Groh, the Smad, the Kishokhan, the Yochishokhan, as well as it seems from the Gemara itself, Tzar Bale Chaim is a biblical prohibition. It's not a chumrah, it's not something nice, it's a biblical prohibition that we may not cause unnecessary pain to animals. You'll notice in this long list here, I left the Rambam out because the Rambam, Kedarko, he likes to also provide much material for people to study. There have been numerous articles written about the position of the Rambam. If it's derais or derabonin, I won't get into it. But there seem to be a stira within the Rambam, whether it's derais or derabonin. The question is, if it's a biblical prohibition, is it a biblical prohibition on causing pain to animals? Or is there a biblical obligation for me to make sure that animals are not in pain? What's the difference? Well, I certainly can't take my dog and break his leg. That would be a prohibition of Tzar Bale Chaim. But what if I see a dog with a broken leg suffering in the street? Do I have an obligation to stop and help the dog? Do I have an obligation to pay a veterinary bill in order to help that animal be relieved of his pain? So the Eish Lavrom Butak, the two Eish Lavrom, the Prima Garden and this one, discusses that. He first wants to say that it doesn't apply to anybody else's animal, applies to animals that you have achrayas on, that are your animals. If I have a dog, I have to make sure that he's not in pain. If I have a cow, I have to make sure that he's not suffering. If my neighbor's animal breaks its leg, I don't have an obligation to take care of it, and certainly if there's a hefker animal. However, he doesn't end so clearly, and that you're going to have to ask your local Orthodox rabbi if you find a dog with a broken leg in the street, whether it's an obligation to pay the veterinary bill. Again, the Maram Shik also, and he ends, L'chein also Shabbat, Ditzar Balechaim, Le'inyin Behem Tohu Deraita. Your animals, you have a biblical obligation. There is a distinction, the Maram Shik says, between your animal, which you have a bigger obligation towards, and somebody else's animal, or a hefker animal. In summary, for this section, and we'll continue the next section next week, is the Kitzur Shulchan Aruch. He says, Asur min haTorah letzar kol bal chai. Actively, I can't cause pain to any animal. It doesn't matter mine or somebody else's. But adarabah, the exact opposite. He says, I have to prevent suffering, even if it's a hefker animal, even if it's a non-Jewish. Now, hold on. Very important. We're going to see the ach in a second. There was one of these Parsha sheets a few years ago, which wanted to make a polemic about a certain issue that was going on here in Israel regarding Tzar Balei Chaim. And it quoted just these first two lines of the Kitzur Shulchan Aruch. They skipped quoting the rest. Ach, imhem etzar l'adam. O shetzorach adam lem refuah. If a person needs them for a medicinal purpose, or the shar davar, or to any other need, mutar. You're allowed to use the animal, afil l'horgon, even to kill them. V'ein choshishin l'tzaron. And we don't worry about their pain. Sherei ha-Torah hetira shchita. The Torah pen of l'chein, and this is quoting from the Ramah that I skipped before, mutar limrot notzot me'avazot chayot. If that's the best way to do it, you could, he says, even take the feathers out of a live goose. Rocky says, don't get carried away. The Jewish people are not cruel, and therefore we don't do such things. And we'll get to that a little later, that there's lefnim mishur tzadin in this concept of Tzar Balei Chaim. But he says, mi'ikar adin, if you don't have any other feathers, you would even be allowed to do that. So this Kitzur Shulchan Aruch, very important. The first part, it's an absolute. Also to cause Tzar Balei Chaim, you have to even prevent it if it's hefker or if it's of a non-Jew. And then he gives the but. And it's very important to have both halves. There's an issa d'oraisa, but there's also a heter, permission to use animals for human need. Again, to weigh and to balance which human needs and what level of suffering. And that we'll have to get to when we see what the different poskim have dealt with when they were asked specific questions. But it's important to quote the whole thing. And again, I said, you know, this group tried quoting only part of it. So next week, I hope to get to the specifics, to get to shailas that have come to the poskim about Tzar Balei Chaim. If there are any questions, there are some chats.
There are,
chats. There's a lot of chats. Oh, no.
It's fine. It's not so much. Okay. You can take a look. I'll just, again, reiterate. Okay, a pleasure to see everybody. Invite your friends. Join us this evening. As I mentioned right at the beginning, Rabbi Joel Finkelstein, who was a classmate of mine in Yeshiva University, rabbi in Memphis, Tennessee for many years, will be giving the Parshat HaShavuah shiur. Tomorrow morning, 9:30, I'll be giving Pirkei Avot shiur. Next week, okay. Adam Mintz finishes his series, so please join us for our learning. Invite your friends. And Dr. R, if you had a chance to look through some questions.
So some of them, I see somebody wrote here about, when I was talking about Shchita, I guess I said that it was less pain. Somebody wrote, if it doesn't cause pain, what do they thrash about? I didn't say it doesn't cause pain. I said, the Torah said we may kill animals for food, and it then gave us a method that is less painful or the least painful. It may cause some pain or suffering. I didn't say it doesn't cause any. So that's correct. And the person, there's no compassionate way to murder someone who doesn't want to die. But it's very hard to know the pain and suffering. Maybe we'll get to that next week. The person who wrote a bullet to the head would be quicker. Okay, we're not going to get into Shkita now. That's for another topic. Somebody also did say that some species of doves made for life, according to Google. Again, it may be. But what I wanted to learn from that, I just think the important point there is that the Bala Turam was expressing his sensitivity, whether his facts were accurate or not. He thought it's important that the Torah should tell us not to break up a pair that was mated for life. I see Matt Lumen wrote about the U.S. Humane Slaughter Law. Indeed, Matt Lewin's father was very involved in fighting for legalizing shechita in the United States. And Matt doesn't yet know, but his daughter got an email a few days ago regarding the need for some legal assistance in Europe, which I'm sure she'll be happy for. And let's see, not to have portion of living animal is one of the seven. Correct, and it could be under that as well. In other words, the Sheva Mitzvahs Bnei Noach includes Eva Minachai, and Sar Balechai may be under that as well. Meaning, just because we don't usually think of it as one of the Sheva Mitzvahs Bnei Noach, that's because each of them is really a whole category. How do we justify Kaparot swinging? That's a very good question. The question is how it's done. Today, it's a lot of the places that are set up are really not set up ideally. And the chickens are left out in the heat, they're left without water, they're left in very crowded conditions. That, it was very hard to justify. To justify kaparot would not be hard. Meaning, if I have a chicken, and I have, he's my only chicken, and I take him and I swing him, swinging the chicken for 10 seconds over my head is very minimal suffering for that chicken. And if there's a real minig, and again, the Shulchan Aruch doesn't think there's a minig of kaparot, the Ramah does think there's a minig of kaparot. If there's such a minig, to justify it, if it's done properly, is not so hard. To justify how it's often done today in the streets of, I'm sorry to say, Beit Shemesh or Yerushalayim or Brooklyn, that's very hard to justify. So, and again, because something is done in a certain way, doesn't mean you have to throw out the goal with the method today. Just like there are places where shechita is done terribly, and there are places where shechita is done much better. Because there's a place that doesn't treat the animals properly while they're being transported or brought into the slaughterhouse, doesn't mean that shechita is bad. It means that the what's being done around it. Hopefully we can talk about that next week, when we talk about some of the specifics, and maybe we'll get into shechita as well. Okay, if there are any other questions.
I have a live question. I have a question. From what I understand, I think in some cases, halachically, if an animal had been sanctified and then it becomes impure, we're told to...
Oh, great. Yeah. Machnis and also lekipa. That's a very hard one. I really...
Maybe if you can explain to other people what that is, just because it... Yeah.
I'm not sure I have a good answer about machnis and also lekipa. You put him into a kipa and you feed him bad food until he explodes. Yeah, there are instances, there are five instances of what's called chatot tametot, five types of korban chatot, where if, let's say, the person had brought an alternate, he lost the sacrifice, and he brings another one, and now what's he going to do with this one? So there are five instances where the animal has to just be left to die. And the Gemara says, you machnisen oso lekipa, you put him basically in jail, and you feed him this bad food until he gets so sick and then he dies. I don't really have a nice explanation or justification. I've thought about it. If anybody comes across anybody that discusses it, unfortunately, I have not come across any sources that talk about it and that really explain it well.
Okay, I have one more. I think it says with Shiluach HaKen, we go out of our way to say that it's not compassion.
Hold on a second, if I may. Marty Lakshin on Tuesday, who's giving a whole series on Tamei Mitzvot, spent a lot of time on that. The Gemara that says, if you say, Al-Kantzipor Yagiu Rachamecha Meshatkin Oto, and he basically showed the many disagree with that Mishnah. To put it very simply, many, I would say most commentaries. Ari, I didn't mean to interrupt, but...
No, in Shiluach HaKein, there's no one answer I'm going to give. It's exactly, there are two streams of thought within the literature. One stream of thought says that the Torah commanded it because it's merciful to take the egg that way. And the other stream of thought is no, it's not merciful at all, but the Torah permitted it in this case. And then under that, you have two streams of thought regarding the mitzvah of Shiluach HaKein. One says that do it only if you want to take the baby or the egg. There's no mitzvah to go out and do it. There's a mitzvah to take a lulav. There's a mitzvah to eat a matzah. There's no mitzvah to put up mezuzah. You put up mezuzah if you have a house. I don't know if they're going around buying houses to put up mezuzahs. So too, there's no mitzvah to do shiluch ken unless I want to take the egg or the chick. There's another school of thought that says no, that shiluch ken is, this is a more Kabbalistic, there's spiritual reasons to it, and one should go out and try to do the mitzvah of shiluch ken if they can. And you read it all the time in the papers. Every few months you read it about somebody who, you know, set up a system or went looking for shiluch ken because they wanted to do that mitzvah. So again, within shiluch ken, you have two streams of thought, whether it's merciful or not, and then whether you should do it only when you want it or whether you should go out and do it.
If I may, I think that second stream of thought is very minor, if I would say that you should do it. And the Chama Leibowitz has her famous thing, ki kare kansipur, if you happen to come across, unlike bakei shalom v'rotfehu, in other words, ki kare, if it happens. So there may be some Kabbalists, I know people do it, but I think that's a very minor strain in our
tradition.
Well,
it's gained a lot of traction today. I can tell you from
lots of things that are
a lot
minor
of emails that I get.
And
there's an entire book on it. Somebody wrote an entire book on Shiluch HaKein. So,
One question about the source about Azov Tazov Imo. If that's going to be the source, then it's clearly referring to someone else's animal. So, If the source for Tzar Bar Lichaim only refers to your own animal, you can't use that source.
That's a good point. You're saying just like if I'm going to learn from Bilam, I have to learn it applies to non-Jews. If I'm going to learn from that, I have to learn it applies to someone else's animal as well. Except that I could learn from that one. I could say, again, the Torah was teaching me a principle. It was teaching me about not liking suffering of animals. And it gave me an example of an extreme, but not that I learn exactly like that case, that it always applies to other people's animals as well. So I could come up with, but that's a good point. Okay,
thank you, everybody. Okay. Thank you, Dr. Rabbi Ari. A pleasure, and we look forward to seeing you next week. And Shabbat Shalom. I know we have to do some catching up in the Parshiot, but I have to do a lot of catching up for all the Parshiot I've missed in Shul for the last 3 months. So anyways, okay.
Okay.
Be well. Look forward to seeing you this evening, if we can make it, and tomorrow morning, and all the best. Be well, be safe, and have a wonderful day. Thank you. Bye-bye.